Case number 08-5127, Jia Zanut, Appellant versus Kenneth Y. Tomlinson, Chairman, Broadcasting Board of Governors. Mr. Shea for the appellant, Mr. Birch for the appellee.
Mr. Shea?
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Timothy Shea. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Kyo Jia Nyunt. And I have the privilege this morning of defending an express statutory preference for U.S. citizen, the U.S. citizenship in the employment of full-time employees at a federal agency. And likewise, to defend the application of a U.S. citizen, Mr. Nyunt, in connection with the decision by the agency to pass over him for an alien. The statute, as we set out at some...
Before we get to the statute, I take it the district court decided on a standing ground, right?
That is correct.
If you could address, we normally like to hear that first because it goes to our jurisdiction.
Certainly. The district court decided that Mr. Nyunt had not shown the requisite interest or injury in connection with the selection. We have responded with what I think is an avalanche of cases dealing with economic regulation and preferences or disabilities imposed by statute on people seeking government, either contracts and other benefits, that if the district judge might rationalize his result by saying, this plaintiff cannot show he would have been selected in this process.
That doesn't seem actually to be the problem. The district court seemed to say that you weren't seeking reinstatement or seeking the position at all.
That's wrong, right?
Your position is that that's wrong.
That is correct.
Okay.
And we sought back pay.
The district court says
fraud.
He does not seek the VA 0329 position. And your position is that he did.
He does, and he did. And we sought back pay, we sought front pay. Now, the government's position is now, well, you're not entitled to back pay and you're not entitled to front pay, but we sought back pay and we sought front pay. We also sought to set aside we sought a declaration that the decision was contrary to law and that the policy itself was contrary to law.
Well, leave both of those aside for the moment. Assume you can't get back pay, you can't get front pay. Were you seeking the position?
Yes.
Were you seeking that because your client had the best scores, he'd be placed in the position?
That is correct. Yes, we do.
Okay.
We did then and we do now. And front pay, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, but front pay is really a substitute for being put in the position.
Right. So that's why you say that an order be issued for front pay if the BBG does not or will not employ the plaintiff.
That's correct. So that's been our position all along.
Again, before you get to the merits of the interpretation of the statute, could you discuss the question of whether under our case law in the CSRA, and particularly our most recent decision is in Gros Didier, and then Judge Roberts' opinion in Fornaro, whether you have to go the CSRA route?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that's a very fundamental question. And keep in mind, we may say here, the provision of law we're seeking to vindicate is an express provision of the organic act of the agency. We're not trying to vindicate something in CSRA at all. And it seems to me the argument is circular from the agency point of view that we have to go to some other place to vindicate that particular right. In Gros Didier, the district court made absolutely clear that plaintiffs in that case were not challenging the regularity of the rule. They were challenging the way the rule was applied. It was a claim of arbitrary and capricious, not that the rule was not in accordance with law or in excess of statutory authority. This claim here is a claim for one that is in excess of statutory authority, number one. And what we're trying to vindicate is an express limitation on the organic act of the agency. And in the decision by this court, in the case of National Treasury versus Chertoff, this court examined the question. There were, when HHS was founded, the Homeland Security Agency was founded, there was a substantial debate on the interest of the administration at that time to have a new, more flexible employment provisions made available to the agency decision makers. They extracted some concessions out of Congress, and they were put in that legislation. There were then some rules adopted by the agency that went pretty far in trying to extend those provisions. This court had no trouble evaluating those agency rules, and what they were doing is precisely what we proposed doing here.
Can I pause over that? If Gross Didier doesn't resolve that question, your argument is that this is a question of statutory interpretation, and that's different than an application.
That is correct.
So what do you do with then-Judge Roberts' opinion in Fornaro, which said the CSRA was the only route, notwithstanding that that case involved, quote, a difficult question of statutory interpretation, namely whether LEOs, law enforcement officers, who fail to meet the age 50 or 20 years requirements because of death are nonetheless entitled to a larger annuity?
Your Honor, most of those cases, overwhelmingly the CSRA cases, are cases about agency benefits and retirement benefits and things like that, which are really confined to, there's an internal agency process in reviewing those. The first case is about a reassignment, for instance, and I can't remember the name of that case. But the balance of the cases are primarily issues about fringe benefits and things like that. There is an internal process.
You're asking for essentially an interpretation of Leadham versus Kind that doesn't seem on its face consistent with Leadham versus Kind.
Which is the ultra vires,
right.
The ultra vires doctrine.
Right.
And as for that, we do, first of all, as for that, Your Honor, with all due respect, we are unapologetic in saying that principle ought to apply. It seems to me.
Which principle, Leadham or the ultra vires doctrine?
The ultra vires doctrine. I'm sorry if I misapprehended perhaps Judge Williams' question.
Leadham leaves room for some room for getting around statutory preclusions of review.
Yes.
And we've formulated that in terms of ultra vires action. So, I mean, I understand the category, and I think I understand your claim that this fits into that category, but I don't see how distinguishing prior cases on the basis they involve benefits rather than hiring gets you anywhere
argument. If I may say, Your Honor, first of all, there is a mechanism at OPM or at MSPB to resolve this. The claim here, and this is very fundamental, the claim here is that it doesn't matter what the agency can do what it wants. The agency can hire aliens with or without this provision, in effect, because they're urging that this court should take no judicial review. So, in effect, this agency, and for that matter any agency, could hire aliens with or without this provision, and it will never be subject to any judicial review. That is the consequence of the position urged by the government here.
It's an assumption of all these cases that there will be certain things, in principle illegal, that will go without judicial review. Is hiring an alien so astonishingly awful that it's just beyond question that has to be subject to judicial review?
Well, Your Honor, there are other limitations, as you know. There are funding limitations on it and things like that. But here there is an express limitation in the statute. And our view is that we're not trying to vindicate some provision of CSRA.
Again, the premise of these cases is that there will be things, there will be acts by agencies which are in principle in violation of law, which will happen without judicial review.
Your Honor, first of all, this takes place in the context of the APA, which establishes a presumption of review.
That's the question, whether it takes place in the context of the APA. It's not the answer.
Feilbark stated explicitly what Judge Williams is noting that there are going to be some areas with no judicial review.
But to the extent it is, it's that is a presumption that CSRA preempted the field.
Right.
And our position here, and I don't really think there's any dispute, that what we're trying to point out is that this is a provision of the organic act of the agency. And if the agency position is they want to transfer this to some other locus, we're saying no. It's a limitation that's expressed by Congress. It didn't happen by accident. We labor in some detail to show that Congress expressly set this out for some very specific reasons. And so this is not a CSRA case. And my point is that, like, it's in the same vein as the Chertoff case, when this court looked, those were personnel rules involved in the Chertoff case. In Chertoff, this court could have said, wait a minute, all those personnel rules are subsumed in CSRA, and if you don't have it. And in that case, the court examined the underlying constraints in the Organic Act establishing Homeland Security and decided that the rules were contrary to that. That is the analogy that applies to this case. And they did that with little or no discussion of CSRA.
Saying no.
What's that?
I don't think it was little. I think it was no.
I think the answer was no, too. Correct. And I think it was under the straightforward analysis that the court appreciated that the constraints in the Organic Act were intended to apply to them. The APA would apply that in the ordinary course.
How could you just say how that's different than Fornaro, other than that one has to do with benefits and one not? The plaintiffs in Fornaro, as Judge Roberts said, challenged legality of a system-wide policy in a manner allegedly entirely collateral to a substantive claim to entitlement, and therefore they claim that they need not be relegated to the remedies set forth in the CSRA for individual claims. And yet the court held that this was barred, that whether barred or not, the only route was through the CSRA.
Well, I, Your Honor, I have to tell you, as I stand here now, I can't remember which personnel issue was at issue. Some of these cases, I just don't remember the underlying policy that was at issue in Fornaro, to be perfectly honest. I remember these cases arise out of a claim in which somebody sought a judicial review of a reassignment, which is a perfectly ordinary day-to-day act that has nothing really to do with, you know, the something that could have been subsumed by CSRA. But here,
could this case not go under? Could you not go to the special counsel and then to the MSPB on this case?
There is no, Your Honor.
Why not?
There is no relief for that.
Why is that?
Because first of all, they don't have authority for the very reasons that are played out right here. The agency is claiming deference to its one-line policy. Policy is distilled into this one policy, and that's not something that either MSPB or CSRA, and we cite cases at MSPB and CRA saying basically they don't look behind agency rules, and they don't. And there's no contention here that there's relief for that in those agencies, not from BBG anyway.
Well, would you be able to appeal to the Federal Circuit then if you lost before the MSPB?
No. MSPB of Federal Circuit is a court, of course, of limited jurisdiction.
Yeah.
In fact, what happens in the district court, and I would suggest in courts of appeals, is review of agency rules that are not in consonance with their Organic Act. It seems to me that happens day in, day out.
Why wouldn't an appeal lie to the Federal Circuit?
The Federal Circuit is a court of limited jurisdiction. And at least the lower courts don't, that is MSPB and the Office of Special Counsel, and certainly EEOC, and we cite, they don't review agency, they're not,
they don't,
outside their jurisdiction.
It's outside.
It's a construction of an organic act.
But is
it
outside?
Likewise, they have no, it's outside their purview. And so they would, and it seems to me,
What do you cite for the proposition that a decision of the MSPB deferring to the agency's interpretation could not be reviewed by the Federal Circuit? I don't know the answer. It's not a trick question. I don't know.
We make that. I have a footnote in my opening brief arguing that it is unreviewable by both of those agencies. And if the question is it reviewable by the Federal Circuit on review, on a refusal to to examine that. I have not examined that question. In other words, I have cited MSPB cases and EEOC cases saying they wouldn't review agency rules. And I might add, it would be very peculiar in that circumstance. If I'm going to EEOC, for EEOC to examine a BBG construction of a BBG organic act, that is the agency construction, it would be just as if in Chertoff, going to one of to MSPB or EEOC, challenging the construction of HHS of their organic act. I don't think they're certainly not in a position to do that. The EEOC is not in a position to do that, nor is MSPB.
Further questions?
Thank you.
I hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, Alan Birch on behalf of the government. With me at council table is Craig Lawrence, Assistant United States Attorney, and Elizabeth Parrish with the Broadcast Board of Governors. The only remaining claim here is the challenge to the agency policy, but as the district court correctly found, the plaintiff lacks standing because the plaintiff has not alleged any future injury, any future possibility of injury from a redesigned policy.
Well, doesn't he say he wants the job?
He doesn't cite anything for that, Your Honor, and I couldn't find anything in the complaint that says that he's seeking reinstatement.
Page A16, it says that an order be issued for front pay and benefits if the BBG does not or will not employ the plaintiff, and G, such other legal and equitable relief as may be just and proper. I mean, you only get front pay if you would otherwise have the job, right? Front pay is the difference between actually getting the pay from the time in which you're ordered, an order is issued saying you're entitled to the job, to the time you actually get the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that assumes an order directing that he'd be given the job. I'm not saying he'd get the job. That's a merits question.
I think that's a pretty heavy gloss on the demand.
What else can it mean?
The
if the BBG does not or will not employ plaintiff?
I think the proper analysis, Your Honor, is to look at it through the standing analysis, which is presumes that the plaintiff has the right to come forward to cure whatever sort of defects would be required or identified by the district court. More than 3 years have gone by since he filed his complaint, and he has not come forward and said, Judge Bates was wrong, I do intend to apply for future positions. That was all it would take. Now, in the context here, in the procedural context, where the court goes off on standing sua sponte, it's almost an invitation to file a motion for reconsideration saying, wait a minute, yes, I do intend to apply for future positions. He hasn't done that. That clearly would have been something that would have been proper for him to allege.
And yet, there's no rule that says you have to, before you can appeal, you have to ask for reconsideration. Is there?
No, not at all, Your Honor, but I'm just suggesting here that it would have been particularly appropriate, especially to cure a standing problem, which is very typically cured in this manner. Now, we've had 3 years have gone by. There have been nothing to suggest that the district court was wrong about that. There was nothing. He doesn't challenge it in his brief.
Is there a question what the reasonable reading of that particular sentence is? And if a reasonable reading is that he's implicitly asking to be reinstated, why shouldn't we give it that?
Well, that, I think, goes to the question of whether it has to be one or the other. And I don't think that's necessary for the government to win. I mean, we've argued it perhaps as a dilemma where, in fact, I think if he argues both at the same time, that he's seeking both to challenge the policy and reinstatement, that both claims fail for separate reasons. He can't challenge the policy because he lacks standing, because he hasn't alleged any future harm.
The question I'm trying to pose to you is, if it is a reasonable reading of that sentence, that he is asking for a reinstatement, why shouldn't we proceed on that basis?
About, the sentence about back pay or front pay, I mean?
The sentence that says, order to be issued front pay and benefits if the BBG does not or will not employ a plaintiff.
But he's not asking the court to order reinstatement.
I understand that he's not literally asking that.
Well, I assume I think the better reading of that, Your Honor, is that it refers to the challenge to the policy, that if they adopt the new policy and they refuse at that point on a voluntary basis to instate the plaintiff, then he seeks the front pay. But that's consistent with reading the language as supporting the claim for challenging the policy. That's why I think it's quite a gloss to read both claims into that same sentence. Now,
is there any remedy available for this in the CSRA process? Obviously, under our case law, it doesn't matter, but I'm curious what the answer to that is.
For this, do you mean the instatement or the challenge to the policy?
The seeking relief as someone claiming that there's been a violation of 1474 because they were a suitably qualified citizen. Is there relief for that anywhere in the CSRA process?
I would argue no, because of the Carducci line of cases. Clearly, he can't get
There's no relief here, I know. I'm saying if you went into the CSRA, you're saying that car is controlled by...
Could he have gone to the OSC, lost, applied to the MSPB, lost, and gone to the Federal Circuit? That's
the
question.
Of course, Your Honor.
He could have.
With this claim under 1474?
Well, I'm not sure that it would state a claim, if that's what you're asking, but I mean, the process is available to him.
I know the process is there.
Right.
I'm wondering if 1474 were raised in that process.
You mean as a personnel practice or something like that? I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But I do think it's clear that even if you view it as their opening brief styled it, which is purely a question of challenging the policy, that the Fornaro case and also Feilbark, I think, speak directly to that. Feilbark has the language about we treat the CSRA and Congress's related employment statutes as covering the field of federal employee claims.
The reason this might be relevant anyway is with respect to the second half of Leadham versus Kine. That is, if there is an alternative route, then Leadham is out. If there isn't, then we can only rely on the first part of Leadham. So it's not irrelevant. It might make resolution easier if it were the case that there is an alternative route. That's why I'm asking.
I see, Your Honor. I'm not familiar enough with the ins and outs of the room, as I mentioned earlier, so okay. I can't answer that.
It does seem odd that Congress would enact a statute making sure U.S. citizens were getting jobs, and then it's just for show.
It's not just for show, Your Honor. I mean,
just for show if an agency can violate it with impunity and no review anywhere.
I think you're sort of skipping past the Chevron question of whether it's a violation or a reasonable interpretation of the statute.
The statute seems pretty clear to me. If there's a suitably qualified U.S. citizen, that person's supposed to be hired over an alien.
But there's
not the best qualified, not equally qualified, just suitably qualified. That seems pretty clear. I mean, it seems that if you're hiring someone who's a alien over someone who meets the base level of qualifications, that seems to me a plain violation of the statute. That's just my reaction. But
suitably qualified ought to mean something different than just qualified, Your Honor, and that's the interpretation that would be required to uphold your position and the position.
Not unsuitably, is that the theory?
Well, suitably is a word that implies quite a bit of judgment and deference in a context-specific way, and that's exactly what the agency
is. Qualified?
Excuse me?
Best qualified?
It can mean best qualified, and that's how the agency has interpreted it. Indeed, I would argue that the word suitably signals an express delegation of Congress by Congress to the agency to fill in what the term means.
Well, let's make the hypothetical harder. Imagine the statute said no alien may ever be hired by this agency. And they did. And the plaintiff here has the very best scores of non-aliens. Your position would, I take it, still be the same, right?
No alien may ever be hired?
Your position
there's very little room for interpretation there.
There's no room for interpretation. Your argument that he can't bring a claim under the APA because of CSRA preemption would still be the same.
That's true, Your Honor, but then the Leadham v. Kine may kick in at that point because at that point I would think you're pretty clearly off the reservation if the statute...
All right. So then you don't think that a Leadham jurisdiction, strictly construed, is precluded by our CSRA cases?
Ooh. I hadn't thought about that, Your Honor.
That's the purpose of the hypothetical.
Yes. Suppose I think about it now. My first reaction would be to admit that I'm weaker than I should be on the Leadham v. Kine basis, whether it's constitutional or statutory. And that would be where I would begin my analysis to try to disentangle whether it can trump the Carducci.
We have held, for example, in the National Air Traffic Controllers case, that LEADM applies even though Congress precluded direct judicial review expressly. So that is, it applies where it applies. It doesn't always apply.
Yes, I take your point. You're right, yes. Well, that would seem to tip in favor. I like I said, I can't comment intelligently because I don't know enough about the basis.
Other questions?
Are there further questions? We'd ask that the judgment below be affirmed. Thank you.
Is there any time left? I will give you a minute. We'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to follow up, if I may, on that colloquy, and I think where this gets us to is a specific reference of what does the statute mean? And I think, if I may say, I agree with the, I think the agency's truth position is they can do what they want. And it may well be that, to the extent that there's an argument about deference here, that is distilled into one sentence in this record. And that one sentence appears, I believe, on the record at page A30. The one sentence says, the law provides non-citizens may be employed only when there are no suitably qualified. The deference that this court is called on, the one sentence this court is called to refer to is, based on congressional committee reports, the agency has interpreted the term suitably qualified to mean equally or better qualified. That's it.
Let's take one possible meaning of suitably qualified, meaning some minimum baseline requirements. Has the BBG actually promulgated minimum baseline requirements for this job?
The answer is yes, they have.
Suppose that's confronted with someone who meets the minimum baseline requirements as formulated in some whatever document has formulated it, and someone who, in the judgment of the board, is three times as effective. Still barred? They were lax in formulating the minimum baseline, and so now they're stuck with some turkey instead of someone almost infinitely superior.
The answer, I think, is the questions presented here, Your Honor, is have they?
Don't accept the turkey characters.
All right, no, you're right.
No, Thanksgiving is still a couple weeks away.
The question that's presented here is that they've interpreted it as best qualified, and I think best qualified.
There are a whole range of possible meanings. I'm just trying to see how far you push with the idea of suitably qualified.
Your Honor, it is.
I can understand an agency formulating a minimum baseline so that you know it is better not to have the position filled at all than to take someone below that line. Okay, so I understand that. Question is, does that formulation bar them from hiring an alien who is, in my hypothetical, three times as good as the non-alien who has just crept over the suitably qualified line? Suitably qualified for their own internal purposes, not something designed not for interpretation of the statute at all.
Your Honor, for some 20 years or more, the agency administered the statute in that manner, as you know. And then it was only in 19, whatever it was, when these committee, so-called committee reports, which are not committee reports, they're committee comments, and on appropriations that they seized on as a basis for changing the policy. But
I understand they had a different interpretation before. The question I'm asking you is, does the language of the law lock them forever into that interpretation, including addressing the hypothetical that I've given you?
The answer is, I think the agency might be able to craft a rule that would say the minimum, whatever the minimum qualifications are, suitably means something other than the barest minimum. But they have not done so.
Well, and this statute has to be read because this is an exception to an exception.
Right.
The usual rule is that no aliens can be hired.
That's correct.
That's the usual rule in the U.S. government.
Right.
So the exception is to allow some aliens to be hired, but not when there is a suitably qualified U.S. citizen.
Right.
So that context is important, right?
That's correct. And as I point out, the statute says U.S. citizens. It says that's a plural. And that contemplates that there'd be a pool. That's so it's suitable. It says unless there are no suitably qualified United States citizens, plural, meaning that there's really a pool. If that meant suitably qualified was best qualified, they're talking about a unique descriptor here. That's really
there might be 10 tied for best.
Right. Or 10 superior. Anyway.
All right. Thank you
very much. Unless you have anything further, I'm concluded. Thank you.
Appreciate it. The case will be taken under submission. We'll take a brief recess while the new set of lawyers charges the table.